The Erie Canal. Bruce Springsteen singing for us there. 200 years ago, the 363-mile Erie Canal opened up the interior of the United States, had a big impact on the whole country and certainly on Wisconsin. It was the largest public works project ever attempted, and its impact on the country was really big. And here to talk about it is Lori Lawler back with us, author of the new book, Many Voices, Building Erie. Many Voices, Building Erie, The Canal That Changed America. So maybe you visited the Erie Canal in upstate New York. Do you know how it was constructed a couple hundred years ago or the impact it had on the U.S. and our economy? I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Lori Lawler, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really excited. This is kind of a double birthday for the 200th birthday of the finishing up the canal. And also my book is coming out tomorrow. So it's having its birthday too, which is wonderful.
I was really glad to get an advanced reader copy of it because I wondered, you know, I don't know anything about the Erie Canal. And I learned so much about so many different, not only the canal itself, but what life was like then and how it affected so many different people, men and women, native tribes. It was just a fascinating read. But I'm wondering, how did you come to write the book?
Well, it really was a Wisconsin-originated idea. I was working on another book about a environmental project out in Waukesha County, which was renovating an eight-acre garbage dump and making it into this wonderful nature refuge. And while I was doing that, I came upon a very early Wisconsin settler named John Griffin. And he had his land right near where I was doing some research. And his story really made me start to think. He came to Wisconsin in 1846, and he traveled across the Atlantic. He was only 52 years old at the time, and he was a young man.
Yeah.
He came across, and he boarded a ship at New York Harbor, went up the Hudson River, got to Albany, and then got a ride on the Erie Canal. And he went across, all the way across to Buffalo on the shores of Lake Erie, and then he made his way up in a schooner up the St. Clair River to the Detroit River to the Upper Great Lakes. And then he finally made it to Milwaukee, where he hired a wagon. He ended up in Waukesha County, filed on 112 acres of tall grass prairie, and his story and his letters are so poignant. He's in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah.
And he's writing home to England, and he's kind of homesick. And he writes, though, "I am as good as any man here. I like the look of the country. I shall live and die in this new place." But he was trying to get his relatives to come over, and he kept saying, "You know, the Erie Canal is my favorite part of the ride here," because there was little possibility of drowning. So, yeah, you know, after the Atlantic. But for folks who may not know a lot about the canal, it was very simple. At the time, it was looked at as an engineering marvel, but it's basically 4 feet deep, 40 feet wide, and it went 363 miles across upstate New York. And it transported goods, people, immigrants, tourists on flat-bottom boats. And these boats were pulled by horses.
Horses, yeah.
Right. So,
and somebody had to be holding on to those horses.
Exactly. And often they were children that would be walking along trying to keep everything untangled. So the fastest you could go was 4 miles an hour. It was very slow. But I think, really, the fascinating connection with Wisconsin is that so many people came across the Atlantic, came across the Erie Canal, up through the Great Lakes, places like Milwaukee, Chicago, Toledo, Ohio, Duluth, Minnesota, Marquette, all had their beginnings because of a population surge. And I love this one quote from a writer who said that beer may have made Milwaukee famous, but it was the Erie Canal that made Milwaukee in the first place.
I love that.
Yeah, so we get kind of a connection there with all these people. It was a huge jump in population from 1835, which was basically 10 years after the canal was finished. There were only 11,000 people in Wisconsin. By 1850, there were 305,000. So yeah. it really helped kind of spread population, people farming, getting jobs in cities.
You know, it really was fascinating to me to read your book. I hope a lot of people read it. You describe the canal, or you describe the area as being, let's see, how shall I put it, lower on the east side and higher on the west side as you got to Lake Erie.
Right.
So there was quite an elevation shift upward.
Right.
And there's no machinery here. We're talking people and axes and
shovels, lots of shovels. Yes, exactly. And I think that's a really good point, because at the moment they decided to try this project that everybody thought was sheer madness, the upstate New York was pretty wild. It was a landscape that there were hardly any roads.
Corduroy roads, called them. Exactly. Just logs that were laid across the mud.
Right. And so they had to go up cliffs. They had to blast through dolomite cliff faces. They had to go over mountains. They had to get around whitewater. So one of the things that really makes the story so suspenseful, for me as a writer, really intriguing, was... they had to come up with 8 locks, you know, to actually elevate the boats to get them across that elevation shift, and 18 aqueducts, which are those major giant bridges that would carry. They were sort of viewed as like tourist attractions once they got the thing going. So there were huge amounts of quicksand. They had all kinds of issues with trying to get across. And I think what's amazing to me is that at the point where they decided to try this, there were no trained engineers in America.
Yeah, not a single one.
Not one, and no engineering schools, which is kind of amazing also. They only had, as you said, they had shovels, they had picks, they had animals pulling wagons, they had wheelbarrows, and that was it, and saws.
Well, there was a guy by the name of Elkin Watson who was, he was the guy that saw it through right from beginning to end. He was a really interesting guy, a very smart guy. Started a whole bunch of things. I think he started the free public school system was his idea.
Yeah. Well, I think, and DeWitt Clinton was also another enormously amazing people. And that's, you know, that there's the technical part that really intrigued me, but also the people, you know, and there were so many heroes who we don't even know about, who did amazing things. So there was another very young man who's only 26. His name was Canvas White. Yeah. And he was self-taught, a surveyor and a mathematician. And he decided when he got the job that he didn't know how to build a canal.
So he'd never seen one.
No. So he goes on his own dime. He goes to England. He tries to see as many canals as he can. In Europe, there are many canals. And so he tried to see how they built aqueducts, how they built locks. But the main thing that he discovered when he was there that makes him really heroic is he found a recipe for waterproof cement, which they didn't have here. So that would, all those locks that had stones that were put together with stone had to be glued together or stuck together with something. And he was the one who he basically saved the day.
And there was, Watson had proposed 62 locks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they didn't wind up with that many.
No, they didn't. But the Europeans, they asked if they'd come over and help, and they were like, no way. This project is too crazy. So the Americans were really on their own. And I think what I really love about the story is with sort of that go ahead anyway view of engineers like Canvas White and Elkanah Watson, like, just go ahead and try it and make mistakes and see if you can pull it off. And even though they didn't really know what they were doing, they managed somehow.
And it was interesting to me that they tried to get some federal support for it, and the government said, no, this is your dime to spend. And so the state of New York fronted all the cost for it.
Right.
So he comes up with, like, an idea for three sections.
Right.
He's got, and he starts in the middle.
Right.
And there was some politics going on there that helped him out with that middle section.
Yeah. DeWitt Clinton was a very clever politician, and he was a good PR man. He knew if he started at the either end, the eastern section or the western section, it would be really rough because there
hard.
Was yeah, exactly. But the middle section was the easiest. So he thought, if I get that done, I show everybody we did it, he'll get more enthused to support, he'll get tax dollars, people will be excited about investing. So that's why they did it that way. But the whole thing became like a race for time because he had in his mind 4th of July. He wanted to get it all done by the 4th of July.
Well, we're talking about years.
Years and years, like 7 years.
But he
years.
Wanted it done on the 4th of July, the year that it was done.
Yes, he did. That was his goal because he wanted to run for president. So that was his plan, which he never succeeded in doing, unfortunately, because he died before he could do it. But it's kind of, I think there were a lot of really remarkable people involved.
There were indeed, and the challenges as you described them were how they overcame various parts along the way. It's just fascinating reading, and the workers, the laborers, who built the Erie Canal, many of them were Irish descent.
Exactly. And at one point, there were as many as 3,000 people per day working on it. The story that the politicians and the investors told was that it was all built by native-born Americans, which was not true. I mean, the immigrants were absolutely essential, and they really risked their lives. They got cholera. They got yellow fever in some of the swampy areas. And the worst accidents often happened because of explosives. They didn't have TNT. They had just black powder, so they would set these rocks with the explosive.
Dig a hole and
yeah, exactly. And then they'd go every direction, the explosion. So it was a very dangerous job, and we don't even know their names. A lot of them went unrecorded.
And the families, many of them, wives and kids came along. The wives worked, but they had to. None of them were paid extra.
Right.
So
right.
The wives had to develop their own little jobs and so forth along
right.
the way.
Right. A lot of them would like put up kind of boarding houses, so to speak, more like shacks. They'd put up workers there. They'd do cooking, laundry. Kids were, they had a really hard job. They were called jigger bosses. They would bring whiskey and water to the workers on the lines. So the kids were also really part of it. They were also used as powder monkeys. They would carry some of these explosives. And it was very dangerous. There was no health insurance. There was no, if you got killed.
And there was no child labor law either.
No,
so the kids were working at very young ages.
Yeah, they could be 6 or 8 or 9. So it was, as you say, it was a kind of a family operation. And then later when the canal got going, the boats were often owned by families, and they would have, you know, the father might be the captain, and maybe the mother would also help with the captain work, and then she would be the cook, and the kids would have various jobs on the boat as well. So, but I think the real sad part in looking at some of these stories was looking at the Haudenosaunee, as you mentioned.
And we'll get to that. I just want to remind you that we are talking with Lori Lawler today about her book. It's titled Many Voices, Building Erie, the Canal That Changed America. It goes on for sale tomorrow, you'll be able to get a copy. If you have a question right now, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we visit with author Lori Lawler about her book, Many Voices, Building Erie, the Canal That Changed America. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. One of the things I was glad you wrote about was the impact on indigenous folk, the Haudenosaunee, which was, I think, a sort of a confederation of seven tribes throughout that area.
Yeah, it was really an unusual alliance, and there were actually six tribes altogether. You might have heard of them as the Iroquois Confederacy, but they were the Mohawk, the Oneida, the Onondaga, the Cayuga, Seneca, and Tuscarora. And they had this cooperative government set up where they would help each other in times of war, and they would counsel with each other to decide if they were going to war. But what was really interesting to me was the role of women in this culture, this indigenous culture, because they actually had quite a bit of power. And they were, some feminists later say that they were inspired by the way in which women played a very active role in treaty making, in deciding if a nation would go to war, and what would happen with farms, what would happen with housing. So they were really kind of liberated very early.
Yeah, and some women even wrote about it, as you point out in the book, and as I recall.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, the entire economic impact of this cannot be, as you so rightfully point out, cannot be underestimated.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think that economic impact also was reflected in the ways in which it changed the way we communicate. And some people will say that the Erie Canal was sort of like the first superhighway. It was the first internet in a way, because ideas and books and speakers were going east-west along the canal. They were coming, all these things were coming with books, pamphlets, but they were also carrying mail, sort of like our emails today. You know, the fact that you could have this way to communicate with people that you left hundreds of miles away and came to Wisconsin, that there was a way to get back to communicate. And I think that really had a huge impact as well.
Well, and to put it in terms, you talk about the amount of time prior to the canal being constructed to after it was constructed was not a question of just days. It was like weeks.
Yes. Yeah. You could be traveling for months, and depending on the weather, right? If it was raining, if it was snowing. The thing about the canal is that it was only operating when it was spring and summer. In winter, it froze. So yeah. About 20 years after the canal, the railroads came in, and then they sort of created a more constant transportation for folks. But the Erie Canal maintained its viability as a heavy hauler, and it was hauling very heavy freight back and forth. Originally, it was hauling salt, it was hauling lumber, and then bringing out west to places like Wisconsin, finished goods, pianos, boots, all that kind of plows. And so it was this kind of back and forth that really, it really changed America, and it really brought America together, especially in the North, which had enormous impact during the Civil War.
And you mentioned salt, and salt was also important for the development of the canal.
Yes, exactly.
Explain that.
Yeah, this was a really interesting thing. Out in western New York, there are some of the biggest salt deposits in the United States. And so they'd been trying to, it's a pretty arduous process of changing salt into something people can use because it has to be boiled down. But salt was used to preserve meat. It was used in medicines. It was used all different sorts of ways, and it was really important. So salt sort of made the Erie Canal because they realized there was no way to get these amazing salt deposits back east. And so they realized that was another huge reason to push through the canal, and it was something as simple that we take for granted, right? Salt.
Yeah, and yet it played this enormous role. Dave in Janesville couldn't stay with us, but asks if the path of the canal can be traveled today. Are there boat, bike, or car tours of the Erie Canal? And you visited the Erie Canal, but talk about that aspect of it.
Well, I think this is what's so remarkable about this entire transformation, because the Erie Canal today is part of a National Heritage Corridor. So you can kayak in the canal, you can follow the towpaths for biking, for hiking. They have really tried very hard to make this kind of a green space between communities out in the northern part of New York. And so actually in September, there's a World Canal Conference that I'm going to be participating in. People from all over the world are coming in to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the canal, and also to talk about and to visit and to tour in boats the canal today. So yes, it's absolutely possible, and it's people have written about it. It's a very remarkably peaceful way to travel.
Yeah, and the original canal, lots of the original canal, of course, is gone.
It is, and it's been transformed multiple times, made bigger and bigger as it became more and more popular. They kept widening it and kind of changing the route. So I was really excited to be able to go out and see the original part of it and then how it grew. So it's kind of a living thing in that it just, when everyone thought it was over, somebody thought of a new way to kind of resurrect it. So it's a kind of an interesting story.
It is absolutely a fascinating story to me. What struck you the most, or what surprised you the most in your research on this book? And we're just lightly touching on everything that's in this book.
Yeah, I think my one discovery I made that really, really touched me was the people, the ordinary people in upstate New York, who saw these workers coming in, and they were badly treated. They were sick. They would be injured. There was a woman, and her name was Edna Smith, and she and her Quaker husband ran a hospital in their own house.
Yeah.
And she was out in Lockport, which probably was the most dangerous section, because they had to create what they called the Flight of Five. Five locks, one on top of the other, like a stair step up the side of this extremely steep cliff. She wrote about her experiences, and I'm so grateful she did that, because we get a sense of who she was, who her husband was, but then who these people were, who were often nameless and faceless, who did this really hard work of building the canal.
And as I'm trying to remember, there's a photo in the book. Oh, there are many really nice photos and artists and drawings and so forth that artists had done over the years that really give you an idea. Those five steps,
yeah,
I think, are in here.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And he, and they did it like a, it's almost like an S. If you can imagine an escalator, it's like a two-way escalator, one going up, one going down, and the boats would go in. And locks are really fascinating. I've always been really interested in them, the way they operate to use gravity and to use buoyancy to raise up a boat to the next level and then open the gates, and then it goes on to the next level.
It's, yeah, the photo is fascinating. Yeah. of that whole process. And the water, actually, the gravity, it was fairly quick if you come to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. And it kind of, it worked, but it really was based on an idea. The gate itself was quite ancient. Leonardo da Vinci is the one who invented and drew the first gate that was used for locks, and because of keeping the water in, keeping the water out. But it was very exciting. People, even today, people love to watch locks. When I was growing up, we would go on camping trips with my family, and we would go up to Sault Ste. Marie
and watch
and just watch locks. My mother thought it was the most boring thing in the world, but we loved it.
Lori, you have written a fascinating book. Thank you so much for writing it. I hope you sell a whole bunch of copies.
I
loved it. I loved it very much. Lori Lawler, her book is, again, titled Many Voices, Building Erie the Canal That Changed America. Fascinating read, and I hope you get a chance to see it. And thanks again to our producers. It's a big team effort always. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.